This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Blitzed, Drugs in the Third Reich, by Norman Ohler, translated by Sean Whiteside. This book is read by Stefan Rudnitsky. A political system devoted to decline instinctively does much to speed up that process. Jean-Paul Sartre. 1. Methamphetamine, the Volksdroge, 1933-1938. National Socialism was toxic, in the truest sense of the word. It gave the world a chemical legacy that still affects us today, a poison that refuses to disappear. On the one hand, the Nazis presented themselves as clean-cut and enforced a strict, ideologically underpinned anti-drug policy with propagandistic pomp and draconian punishments. On the other hand, a particularly potent and perfidious substance became a popular product under Hitler. This drug carved out a great career for itself all over the German Reich, and later in the occupied countries of Europe. Under the trademark Pervitin, this little pill became the accepted Volksdroge, or people's drug, and was on sale in every pharmacy. It wasn't until 1939 that its use was restricted by making Pervitin prescription only, and the pill was not subjected to regulation until the Reich Opium Law in 1941. Its active ingredient, methamphetamine, is now either illegal or strictly regulated. But with the number of consumers currently at over 100 million and rising, it counts today as our most popular poison. Produced in hidden labs by chemical amateurs, usually in adulterated form, this substance has come to be known as crystal meth. Usually ingested nasally in high doses, the crystalline form of this so-called horror drug has gained unimaginable popularity all over Europe, with an exponential number of first-time users. This upper, with its dangerously powerful kick, is used as a party drug, for boosting performance in the workplace, in offices, even in parliaments and at universities. It banishes both sleep and hunger while promising euphoria, but in the form of crystal meth, it is a potentially destructive and highly addictive substance. Hardly anyone knows about its original rise in Nazi Germany. Breaking Bad, the Drug Lab of the Reich. Under a clean-swept summer sky stretching over both industrial zones and uniform housing, I take the suburban train southeast to the edge of Berlin. In order to find the remnants of the Temmler factory, I have to get out at Adlershof, which nowadays calls itself Germany's most modern technology park. Avoiding the campus, I strike off across an urban no-man's land, skirting dilapidated factory buildings, and passing through a wilderness of crumbling brick and rusty steel. The Temmler factory moved here in 1933. It was only 1 year later that Albert Mendel, the Jewish co-owner of the Tempelhof chemical factory, was expropriated by the racist laws of the regime, and Temmler took over his share, quickly expanding the business. These were good times for the German chemical industry, or at least for its Aryan members, and pharmaceutical development boomed. Research was tirelessly conducted on new, pioneering substances that would ease the pain of modern humanity or sedate its troubles. Many of the resulting pharmacological innovations shape the way we consume medicine today. By now, the former Temmler factory in Berlin-Johannisthal has fallen into ruin. There is no sign of its prosperous past, of a time when millions of Pervitin pills a week were being pressed. The grounds lie unused, a dead property. Crossing a deserted parking lot, I make my way through a wildly overgrown patch of forest and over a wall stuck with broken bits of glass designed to deter intruders. Between ferns and saplings stands the old wooden witch's house of the founder, Theodor Temmler, once the nucleus of the company. Behind dense alder bushes looms a forsaken brick building. A window is broken enough for me to be able to climb through, stumbling into a long dark corridor. Mildew and mold grow from the walls and ceilings, At the end of the hallway, a door stands beckoning, half open, encrusted with flaking green paint. Beyond the door, daylight peers through two shattered lead-framed industrial windows. An abandoned bird's nest hides in the corner. Chipped white tiles reach all the way to the high ceiling, which is furnished with circular air vents. This is the former laboratory of Dr. Fritz Hausschild, head of pharmacology at Temmler from 1937 until 1941, who was in search of a new type of medicine, a performance-enhancing drug. This is the former drug lab of the Third Reich. Here, in porcelain crucibles attached to pipes and glass coolers, the chemists boiled up their flawless matter. Lids rattled on pot-bellied flasks, orange steam released with a sharp, hissing noise, while emulsions crackled and white-gloved fingers made adjustments. Here, methamphetamine was produced of a quality that even Walter White, the drug cook in the TV series Breaking Bad, which depicts meth as a symbol of our times, could only have dreamed of. Prologue in the 19th century, the father of all drugs. Voluntary dependence is the finest state, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. To understand the historical relevance of methamphetamine and other substances to the Nazi state, we must go back before the beginning of the Third Reich. The development of modern societies is bound as tightly with the creation and distribution of drugs as the economy is with advances in technology. In 1805, Goethe wrote Faust in classicist Weimar, and by poetic means perfected one of his theses, that the genesis of man is itself drug-induced. I change my brain, therefore I am. At the same time, in the rather less glamorous town of Paderborn in Westphalia, the pharmaceutical assistant Friedrich Wilhelm Sertürner performed experiments with opium poppies, whose thickened sap anesthetized pain more effectively than anything else. Goethe wanted to explore through artistic and dramatic channels what it is that holds the core of the world together. Sertürner, on the other hand, wanted to solve a major millennium-old problem that has plagued our species to a parallel degree. It was a concrete challenge for the brilliant 21-year-old chemist. Depending on the conditions they are grown in, the active ingredient in opium poppies is present in varying concentrations. Sometimes the bitter sap does not ease the pain quite strongly enough, and other times it can lead to an unintended overdose and fatal poisoning. Thrown back entirely on his own devices, just as the opiate laudanum consumed Goethe in his study, Sertürner made an astonishing discovery. He succeeded in isolating morphine, the crucial alkaloid in opium, a kind of pharmacological Mephistopheles that instantly magics pain away. Not only a turning point in the history of pharmacology, this was also one of the most important events of the early 19th century, not to mention human history as a whole. Pain, that irritable companion, could now be assuaged, indeed removed, in precise doses. All over Europe, apothecaries had, to the best of their ability and their consciences, pressed pills from the ingredients of their own herb gardens or from the deliveries of women who foraged in hedgerows. These homegrown chemists now developed within only a few years into veritable factories with established pharmacological standards. The forerunners of these companies were the Christian monasteries, which produced medications on a large scale even in the Middle Ages and exported widely. In Venice, where the first coffee house in Europe opened in 1647, chemical and pharmaceutical preparations had been manufactured as early as the 14th century. Morphine was not only a method of easing life's woes, it was also big business. In Darmstadt, the owner of the Engel Apotheke, Emanuel Merck, stood out as a pioneer of this development. In 1827, he set out his business model of supplying alkaloids and other medications in unvarying quality. This was the birth not only of the Merck Company, which still thrives today, but of the modern pharmaceutical industry as a whole. When injections were invented in 1850, there was no stopping the victory parade of morphine. The painkiller was used in the American Civil War of 1861-65 and in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. Soon morphine fixes were doing the rounds as normal procedure. The change was crucial. The pain of even seriously injured soldiers could now be kept within bounds. This made a different scale of war possible. Fighters who before would have been ruled out for a long time by an injury were soon coddled back to health and thrust onto the front line once again. With morphine, also known as morphium, the development of pain relief and anesthesia reached a crucial climax, both in the army and in civil society. From the worker to the nobleman, the supposed panacea took the whole world by storm, from Europe via Asia and all the way to America. In drugstores across the United States, two active ingredients were available without prescription. Fluids containing morphine calmed people down, while drinks containing cocaine, such as in the early days, Vin Mariani, a Bordeaux containing coca extract, and even Coca-Cola, were used to counter low moods as a hedonistic source of euphoria and also as a local anesthetic. This was only the start. The industry soon needed to diversify. It craved new products. On August 10, 1897, Felix Hoffmann, a chemist with the Bayer Company, synthesized acetyl salicylic acid from willow bark. It went on sale as aspirin and conquered the globe. 11 days later, the same man invented another substance that was also to become world famous, diacetylmorphine, a derivative of morphine, the first designer drug. Trademarked as heroin, it entered the market and began its own campaign. "Heroin is a fine business," the directors of Bayer announced proudly and advertised the substance as a remedy for headaches, for general indisposition, and also as a cough syrup for children. It was even recommended to babies for colic or sleeping problems. Business wasn't just booming for Bayer. In the last third of the 19th century, several new pharmaceutical hotspots developed along the Rhine. Unlike other more traditional industries, the chemical industry didn't require as much in terms of overhead to get business going, only needing relatively little equipment and raw material. Even small operations promised high profit margins. What was most important was intuition and specialist knowledge on the part of the developers, and Germany, rich in human capital, was able to fall back on an inexhaustible stock of excellent chemists and engineers, trained in what was at the time the best education system in the world. The network of universities and technical colleges was recognized as exemplary. Science and business worked hand in hand. Research was being carried out at top speed, and a multitude of patents were being developed. Where the chemical industry was concerned, Germany was the workshop of the world. Made in Germany became a guarantee of quality, especially for drugs. Germany, the global dealer. This didn't change after the First World War. While France and Great Britain were able to acquire natural stimulants such as coffee, tea, vanilla, pepper, and other natural medicines from colonies overseas, Germany, which lost its comparatively sparse colonial possessions under the terms of the Versailles Treaty, had to find other ways. Stimulants had to be produced synthetically. In fact, Germany was in dire need of artificial assistance. The war had inflicted deep wounds and caused the nation both physical and psychic pain. In the 1920s, drugs became more and more important for the despondent population between the Baltic Sea and the Alps. The desire for sedation led to self-education, and there soon emerged no shortage of know-how for the production of a remedy. The course was set for a thriving pharmaceutical industry. Many of the chemical substances that we know today were developed and patented within a very short period of time. German companies became leaders in the global market. Not only did they produce the most medicines, but they also provided the lion's share of chemical raw materials for their manufacture throughout the world. A new economy came into being, and the picturesque Rhine Valley became a chemical valley of sorts. Previously unknown little outfits prospered overnight and grew into influential players. In 1925, the bigger chemical factories joined together to form IG Farben, one of the most powerful companies in the world, with headquarters in Frankfurt. Opiates, above all, were still a German specialty. In 1926, the country was top of the morphine-producing states and world champion when it came to exporting heroin. 98% of the production went abroad. Between 1925 and 1930, 91 tons of morphine were produced, 40% of global production. Under the obligations of the Versailles Treaty, Germany reluctantly signed the League of Nations International Opium Convention in 1925, which regulated the trade. It was not ratified in Berlin until 1929. The local alkaloid industry still processed just over 200 tons of opium in 1928. The Germans were world leaders in another class of substances as well. The companies Merck, Boehringer, and Knoll controlled 80% of the global cocaine market. Merck's cocaine from the city of Darmstadt was seen as the best product in the world, and commercial pirates in China printed fake Merck labels by the million. Hamburg was the major European marketplace for raw cocaine. Every year, thousands of pounds were imported legally through its port. Peru sold its entire annual production of raw cocaine, over 5 tons, almost exclusively to Germany for further processing. The influential Fachgruppe Opium und Kokain, expert group on opium and cocaine, put together by the German drug manufacturers, worked tirelessly on a close integration of the government and the pharmaceuticals industry. Two cartels, each consisting of a handful of companies, divided up between them the lucrative market of the entire world, the so-called Cocaine Convention and Opiates Convention. Merck was the business leader in both cases. The young Weimar Republic, swimming in consciousness-altering and intoxicating substances, delivered heroin and cocaine to the four corners of the world and rose to become a global dealer. The chemical 20s. This scientific and economic development also resonated with the spirit of the age. Artificial paradises were in vogue in the Weimar Republic. People chose to flee into worlds of make-believe rather than engage with the often less rosy reality, a phenomenon that more or less defined this very first democracy on German soil, both politically and culturally. Many were reluctant to admit the true reasons for the military defeat and repressed the shared responsibility of the Imperial German establishment for the fiasco of the First World War. The malicious legend of the stab in the back gained currency, claiming the German army had only lost the war because of internal sabotage from the left. These escapist tendencies often found expression either in sheer hatred or in cultural excess, most of all in Berlin. Alfred Dublin's novel, Berlin Alexanderplatz, identified the city as the Whore of Babylon, with an incomparably grubby underworld, a place seeking salvation in the most appalling, barely imaginable excesses, particularly drugs. Berlin nightlife, oh boy, the world has never seen the like. We used to have a great army, now we've got great perversities, wrote the author Klaus Mann. The city on the Spree became synonymous with moral reprehensibility. When Germany's currency collapsed, in autumn of 1923, one U.S. dollar was worth 4.2 billion marks. All moral values seemed to plummet with it as well. Everything whirled apart in a toxicological frenzy. The icon of the age, the actress and dancer Anita Berber, dipped white rose petals in a cocktail of chloroform and ether at breakfast before sucking them clean. Films about cocaine or morphine were showing in the cinemas, and all drugs were available on street corners without prescription. 40% of Berlin doctors were said to be addicted to morphine. In Friedrichstrasse, Chinese traders from the former German leased territory of Tsingtao ran opium dens. Illegal nightclubs opened in the back rooms of the Mitte district. Smugglers distributed flyers at Anhalter Station, advertising illegal dance parties and beauty evenings. Big clubs like the famous Haus Vaterland on Potsdamer Platz and Ballhaus Resi notorious for its extravagant promiscuity on Blumenstrasse, attracted potential fun lovers in droves, as did smaller establishments like the Kakadu Bar or the Weiße Maus, where masks were distributed on the way in to guarantee the anonymity of the guests. An early form of sex and drugs tourism from Western neighbors and the United States began, because everything in Berlin was as cheap as it was exciting. The World War was lost, and everything seemed permitted. The metropolis mutated into the experimental capital of Europe. Posters on house walls warned in shrill expressionist script, "Berlin, take a breath. Bear in mind your dance partner is death." The police couldn't keep up. Order collapsed first sporadically, then chronically, and the culture of pleasure filled the vacuum as best it could, as illustrated in a song of the times. "Once not so very long ago, sweet alcohol, that beast, brought warmth and sweetness to our lives. But then the price increased, and so cocaine and morphine Berliners now select. Let lightning flashes rage outside, we snort and we inject. At dinner in the restaurant, the waiter brings the tin of coke for us to feast upon. Forget whiskey and gin. Let drowsy morphine take its subcutaneous effect upon our nervous system. We snort and we inject. These medications aren't allowed, of course, they're quite forbidden, but even such illicit treats are very seldom hidden. Euphoria awaits us, and though, as we suspect, our foes can't wait to shoot us down, we snort and we inject. And if we snort ourselves to death or into the asylum, our days are going downhill fast. How better to beguile 'em? Europe's a madhouse anyway. No need for genuflecting. The only way to paradise is snorting and injecting." In 1928, in Berlin alone, 160 pounds of morphine and heroin were sold quite legally by prescription over the pharmacist's counter. Anyone who could afford it took cocaine, the ultimate weapon for intensifying the moment. Coke spread like wildfire and symbolized the extravagance of the age. On the other hand, it was viewed as a degenerate poison and disapproved of by both communists and Nazis who were fighting for power in the streets. There was violent opposition to the free and easy Zeitgeist. German nationalists railed against moral decay, and similar attacks were heard from the conservatives. Though Berlin's new status as a cultural metropolis was accepted with pride, the bourgeoisie, which was losing status in the 1920s, showed its insecurity through its radical condemnation of mass pleasure culture, decried as decadently Western. Worst of all, the National Socialists agitated against the pharmacological quest for salvation of the Weimar period. Their brazen rejection of the parliamentary system, of democracy, as well as of the urban culture of a society that was opening up to the world, was expressed through tub-thumping slogans directed against the degenerate state of the hated Jewish Republic. The Nazis had their own recipe for healing the people. They promised ideological salvation. For them, there could be only one legitimate form of inebriation, the swastika. National Socialism strove for a transcendental state of being as well. The Nazi world of illusions into which the Germans were to be enticed often used techniques of intoxication. World historical decisions, according to Hitler's inflammatory text Mein Kampf, had to be brought about in states of euphoric enthusiasm or hysteria. So the Nazi Party, NSDAP, distinguished itself, on one hand, with populist arguments, and on the other with torch parades, flag consecrations, rapturous announcements, and public speeches aimed at achieving a state of collective ecstasy. These were supplemented with the violent frenzies of the brown shirts, SA, during the early Kampfzeit, or period of struggle, often fueled by the abuse of alcohol. The foundation of the NSDAP on February 24, 1920, took place in a beer hall, the Hofbrauhaus in Munich. In the early days, alcohol played an important part in the masculine rituals of the far-right party and its SA. This book barely touches on the role of alcohol in the Third Reich, because it deserves a discussion in its own right. Realpolitik tended to be dismissed as unheroic cattle trading. The idea was to replace politics with a state of social intoxication. If the Weimar Republic can be seen in psychohistorical terms as a repressed society, its supposed antagonists, the National Socialists, were at the head of that trend. They hated drugs because they wanted to be like a drug themselves. Switching power means switching substances. While the abstinent Führer was silent, Günter Grass. During the Weimar period, Hitler's inner circle had already managed to establish an image of him as a man working tirelessly, putting his life completely at the service of his people. A picture was created of an unassailable leader figure, entirely devoted to the Herculean task of gaining control of Germany's social contradictions and problems, and to ironing out the negative consequences of the lost World War. One of Hitler's allies reported in 1930, "He is all genius and body, and he mortifies that body in a way that would shock people like us. He doesn't drink, he practically only eats vegetables, and he doesn't touch women." Hitler allegedly didn't even allow himself coffee, and legend had it that after the First World War he threw his last pack of cigarettes into the Danube near Linz. From then onward, supposedly, no poisons would enter his body. We teetotalers have, let it be mentioned in passing, a particular reason to be grateful to our Führer, if we bear in mind what a model his personal lifestyle and his position on intoxicants can be for everyone, reads an announcement from an abstinence association. The Reich Chancellor, ostensibly a pure person, remote from all worldly pleasures, entirely without a private life. An existence apparently informed by self-denial and long-lasting self-sacrifice, a model for an entirely healthy existence. The myth of Hitler as an anti-drug teetotaler who made his own needs secondary was an essential part of Nazi ideology and was presented again and again by the mass media. A myth was created that established itself in the public imagination, but also among critical minds of the period, and still resonates today. This is a myth that demands to be deconstructed. Following their seizure of power on January 30, 1933, the National Socialists suffocated the eccentric pleasure-seeking culture of the Weimar Republic. Drugs were made taboo, as they made it possible to experience unrealities other than the ones promulgated by the National Socialists. Seductive poisons had no place in a system in which only the Führer was supposed to do the seducing. The path taken by the authorities in their so-called Rauschgiftbekämpfung, or war on drugs, lay less in an intensification of the opium law, which was simply adopted from the Weimar Republic, than in several new regulations that served the central National Socialist idea of racial hygiene. The term Droge, drug, which at one point meant nothing more than dried plant parts, was given negative connotations. Drug consumption was stigmatized, and with the help of quickly established new divisions of the criminal police, severely penalized. This new emphasis came into force as early as November 1933, when the Reichstag passed a law that allowed the imprisonment of addicts in a closed institution for up to 2 years, although that period of confinement could be extended indefinitely by legal decree. Further measures ensured that doctors who consumed drugs would be forbidden to work for up to 5 years. Medical confidentiality was considered breakable when it came to detecting consumers of illegal substances. The chairman of the Berlin Medical Council decreed that every doctor had to file a drug report when a patient was prescribed narcotics for longer than 3 weeks, because public security is endangered by chronic alkaloid abuse in almost every case. If a report to that effect came in, two experts examined the patient in question. If they found that hereditary factors were satisfactory, immediate compulsory withdrawal was imposed. Although in the Weimar Republic, slow or gradual withdrawal had been used, now addicts were to be subjected to the horrors of going cold turkey. If assessment of the hereditary factors yielded a negative result, The judge could order confinement for an unspecified duration. Drug users soon ended up in concentration camps. Your identity card at the Reich Central Office for Combating Drug Transgressions could be a matter of life and death. You were defined by a number as a dealer, prescription forger, Eukadal addict, artist, etc., and a color, purple Jew, red, held for drying out, etc. Every German was also ordered to convey observations about drug-addicted acquaintances and family members so that corrective action can be taken immediately. Filing systems were put in place in order to establish a thorough record, enabling the Nazis to use their war against drugs to feed into a surveillance state quite soon after they came to power. The dictatorship extended its so-called health leadership into every corner of the Reich. In every administrative district, there was an anti-drug consortium. Doctors, pharmacists, social security authorities, and representatives of the law, such as the army and the police, were all involved, as well as members of the National Socialist People's Welfare, establishing a full-blown anti-drug web. Its threads converged in the Reich Health Office in Berlin, in Principal Department 2 of the Reich Committee for the People's Health. A duty of health was postulated, which would go hand in hand with the total containment of all demonstrable physical, social, and mental damage that could be inflicted by alcohol and tobacco. Cigarette advertising was severely restricted, and drug prohibitions were put in place to block any remaining breaches of moral codes in our people. In autumn 1935, a new marital health law was passed that forbade marriage if one of the parties suffered from a mental disturbance. Narcotics addicts were marginalized into this category and were branded as psychopathic personalities without the prospect of a cure. This marriage prohibition was supposed to prevent infection of the partner, as well as hereditarily conditioned potential for addiction in children, because among the descendants of drug addicts, an increased rate of mental deviations had been observed. The law for the prevention of hereditarily diseased offspring took compulsory sterilization to its brutal conclusion. For reasons of racial hygiene, we must therefore see to it that severe addicts are prevented from reproducing. Worse was to follow. Under the guise of euthanasia, those considered criminally insane, a category including drug users, would be murdered in the first years of the war. The precise number of those affected is impossible to reconstruct. Of crucial importance to their fate was the assessment on their file cards. A plus meant a lethal injection or the gas chamber. A minus meant a deferral. If an overdose of morphine was used for the killing, it came from the Reich Central Office for Combating Drug Transgression, which had emerged out of the Berlin Drug Squad in 1936 as the first Reich-wide drug police authority. Among the selecting doctors, a mood of intoxicating superiority prevailed. The anti-drug policy served as a vehicle for the exclusion and suppression, even the destruction, of marginal groups and minorities. Anti-drug policy as anti-Semitic policy. The Jew has used the most refined means to poison the mind and the soul of German people and to guide thought along an un-German path which inevitably led to doom. Removing this Jewish infection, which could lead to a national disease and to the death of the people, is also a duty of our health leadership. Medical Journal for Lower Saxony, 1939. From the outset, the racist terminology of National Socialism was informed by linguistic images of infection and poison, by the topos of toxicity. Jews were equated with bacilli or pathogens. They were described as foreign bodies and said to be poisoning the Reich, making the healthy social organism ill, so they had to be eradicated or exterminated. Hitler said, "There is no longer any compromise, because such a thing would be poison to us." In fact, the poison lay in the language itself, which dehumanized the Jews as a preliminary stage to their subsequent murder. The Nuremberg race laws of 1935 and the introduction of the Ahnenpass proof of Aryan ancestry, manifested the demand for purity of the blood. This was seen as one of the supreme goods of the people, and one most in need of protection. Needless to say, this produced a point of intersection between anti-Semitic propaganda and anti-drug policy. It was not the dose that determined the poison, but the category of foreignness. Propagated as the standard work on the subject, the central, entirely unscientific thesis of the book Magische Gifte, Magic Poisons, posits, "The greatest toxic effect is always produced by narcotics alien to the country and the race. Jews and drugs merged into a single toxic or epidemiological unit that menaced Germany. For decades, our people have been told by Marxists and Jews, 'Your body belongs to you.' That was taken to mean that at social occasions between men or between men and women, any quantities of alcohol could be enjoyed, even at the cost of the body's health. Irreconcilable with this Jewish Marxist view is the Teutonic German idea that we are the bearers of the eternal legacy of our ancestors, and that accordingly our body belongs to the clan and the people." SS-Hauptsturmführer Kriminalkommissar Erwin Kosmel, who was from 1941 director of the Reich Central Office for Combating Drug Transgressions, asserted that Jews play a supreme part in the international drug trade. His work was concerned with eliminating international criminals who often have roots in Jewry. The Nazi Party's Office of Racial Policy claimed that the Jewish character was essentially drug-dependent. The intellectual urban Jew preferred cocaine or morphine to calm his constantly excited nerves and give himself a feeling of peace and inner security. Jewish doctors were rumored to be often extraordinarily addicted to morphine. In the anti-Semitic children's book Der Giftpilz, The Poisonous Mushroom, the National Socialists combined their twin bogeymen, Jews and drugs, into racial hygiene propaganda that was used in schools and nurseries. The story was exemplary, the message perfectly clear. The dangerous poison mushrooms had to be eradicated. While the selection strategies in the battle against drugs were directed against an alien power that was perceived as threatening, in National Socialism they almost automatically had anti-Semitic connotations. Anyone who consumed drugs suffered from a foreign plague. Drug dealers were presented as unscrupulous, greedy, or alien. Drug use as racially inferior, and so-called drug crimes as one of the greatest threats to society. It is frightening how familiar many of these terms still sound today. While we have driven out other Nazi verbal monstrosities, the terminology of the war on drugs has lingered. It's no longer a matter of Jews. The dangerous dealers are now said to be part of different cultural circles. The extremely political question of whether our bodies belong to us or to a legal social network of social and health-related interests remains a virulent one even today. The Celebrity Doctor of Kurfürstendamm. The word Jew was smeared on the plaque of a doctor's surgery on Bayreuther Straße in Berlin's Charlottenburg district one night in 1933. The name of the doctor, a specialist in dermatological and sexually transmitted diseases, was illegible. Only the opening hours could still be clearly seen. Weekdays, 11 to 1 and 5 to 7, apart from Saturday afternoon. The overweight, bald Dr. Theodor Morell reacted to the attack in a way that was as typical as it was wretched. He quickly joined the Nazi Party to defuse future hostilities of that kind. Morell was not a Jew. The SA had wrongly suspected him of being one because of his dark complexion. After he had registered as a party member, Morell's practice became even more successful. It expanded and moved into the lavish rooms of a 19th-century building on the corner of Kurfürstendamm and Fasanenstraße. "You joined, you flourished," that was a lesson Morell would never forget, right until the end. The fat man from Hessen hadn't the slightest interest in politics. The satisfaction that made his life worthwhile came when a patient felt better after treatment, obediently paid the fee, and came back as soon as possible. Morel had developed strategies over the years that gave him advantages over the other doctors on Kurfürstendamm, with whom he vied for well-to-do clients. His smart private practice was soon seen as one of the most profitable in the area. Equipped with the most up-to-date technology, all originally bought with the fortune of his wife, Anni, over time it had the whole of high society beating a path to the door of Morel, a former ship's doctor in the tropics. Whether it was the boxer, Max Schmeling, various counts and ambassadors, successful athletes, business magnates, high-powered scientists, politicians, half of the film world, everyone made the pilgrimage to Dr. Morel, who specialized in new kinds of treatment, or, as some mocking tongues had it, in the treatment of non-existent illnesses. There was one field in which this modish, egocentric doctor was considered a pioneer: vitamins. Little was known at the time about these invisible helpers, which the body itself can't produce but which it urgently needs for certain metabolic processes. Injected directly into the blood, vitamin supplements work wonders in cases of undernourishment. This was precisely Morel's strategy for keeping his patients interested, and if vitamins weren't enough, he deftly added a circulatory stimulant to the injection mixture. For male patients, he might include some testosterone, with an anabolic effect for muscle building and potency. For women, an extract of nightshade as an energy supplement and for hypnotically beautiful eyes. If a melancholy theatrical actress came to see him to get rid of stage fright before her premiere in the Admiral's Palast, Morel wouldn't hesitate for a moment, but would reach with his hairy hands for the syringe. He was said to be an absolute master of the injection needle, and there were even rumors that it was impossible to feel the prick as his needle went in spite of the size of the implements at the time. His reputation went beyond the boundaries of the city, and in the spring of 1936, his phone rang in the consulting room, even though he had categorically forbidden his nurses to disturb him during surgery hours. But this was no ordinary phone call. It was from the Braun House, party headquarters in Munich. A certain Schaub on the line, introducing himself as Hitler's adjutant and informing him that Heinrich Hoffmann, the official Reich photographer of the NSDAP, was suffering from a delicate illness. It was the party's wish that Morel, as a prominent specialist in sexually transmitted diseases who was well known for his confidentiality, should take on the case. They didn't want to consult a Munich doctor for such a discreet matter. The Führer, in person, had sent a plane for him, which was waiting at a Berlin airport, Schaub added. While Morel couldn't stand surprises, he also couldn't turn down an invitation like that. Once he arrived in Munich, he was put up at state expense in the Grand Regina Palast Hotel, treated the pyelonephritis that Hoffmann had contracted as a result of gonorrhea, the clap, and was invited with his wife to take a trip to Venice by his influential patient by way of thanks. Back in Munich, the Hoffmanns gave a dinner in their villa in the elegant district of Bogenhausen with the Morels present. There was spaghetti with nutmeg, tomato sauce on the side, green salad, the favorite dish of Adolf Hitler, who was, as this evening, often a guest at Hoffmann's house. The Nazi leader had been closely connected with the photographer since the 1920s, when Hoffmann had made considerable contributions to the rise of National Socialism. Hoffmann, who owned the copyright for important photographs of the dictator, published large numbers of picture books called things like Hitler as No One Knows Him or A Nation Honors Its Führer, and sold them by the millions. There was also another, more personal reason that linked the two men. Hitler's lover, Eva Braun, had previously worked as an assistant for Hoffmann, who had introduced the two in his Munich photographic shop in 1929. Hitler, who had heard a great many good things about the jovial Morel, thanked him before dinner for treating his old comrade, and regretted not having met the doctor before. Perhaps then his chauffeur, who had died of meningitis a few months earlier, would have still been alive. Morel reacted nervously to the compliment, and barely spoke during the spaghetti dinner. The constantly sweating doctor, with the full face and the thick, round glasses on his potato nose, knew that in higher circles he was not considered socially acceptable. His only chance of acceptance lay in his injections. So he pricked up his ears when Hitler, in the course of the evening, talked almost in passing about severe stomach and intestinal pains that had been tormenting him for years. Morell hastily mentioned an unusual treatment that might prove successful. Hitler looked at him quizzically and invited Morell and his wife to further consultations at the Berghof, his mountain retreat in the Obersalzberg near Berchtesgaden. There, a few days later, during a private conversation, the dictator frankly admitted to Morell that his health was now so poor that he could barely perform any action. That was, he claimed, due to the bad treatment given to him by his previous doctors, who couldn't come up with anything but starving him. Then, if there happened to be an abundant dinner on the program, which was often the case, he immediately suffered from unspeakable bloating and itchy eczema on both legs, so that he had to walk with bandages around his feet and couldn't wear boots. Morell immediately thought he recognized the cause of Hitler's complaints and diagnosed abnormal bacterial flora, causing poor digestion. He recommended the preparation Mutaflor, developed by his friend, the Freiburg doctor and bacteriologist, Professor Alfred Nisle, a strain of bacteria that had originally been taken from the intestinal flora of a non-commissioned officer who had, unlike many of his comrades, survived the war in the Balkans without stomach problems. The bacteria are kept in capsules, alive, and they take root in the intestine, flourish, and replace all the other strains that might lead to illnesses. This genuinely effective concept convinced Hitler, for whom even processes within the body could represent a battle for Lebensraum, or living space. Extravagantly, he promised to donate to Morell a house if Mutaflor actually did cure him, and appointed the doctor as his personal physician. When Morell told his wife about his new position, Hani was less than enthusiastic. She commented that they didn't need it, and referred to his thriving practice on Kurfürstendamm. Perhaps she already sensed that she would rarely get to see her husband from now on, because a very unusual relationship would form between Hitler and his personal physician. Injection cocktail for patient A. He alone is responsible for the inexplicable, the mystery and myth of our people. Joseph Goebbels. The dictator always hated being touched by other people, and refused treatment from doctors if they inquired too invasively into the causes of his ailments. He could never trust a specialist who knew more about him than he did himself. Good old general practitioner Morell, with his cozy, harmless air, gave him a sense of security from the very beginning. Morell had no intention of questioning Hitler to genuinely find the root of his health problems. The penetration of the needle was enough for him. It was a substitute for serious medical treatment. If the head of the state was to function and demanded to be made immediately symptom-free, whatever his complaints, Morell hesitated no more than he would when treating an actress at the Metropole Theater, but instead prepared a 20% Merck glucose solution or a vitamin injection. Immediate removal of symptoms was the motto, followed not only by the bohemian circles of Berlin, but also by Patient A, as he appeared in Morell's books. Hitler was delighted by the speed with which his condition improved, usually while the needle was still in his vein. His personal doctor's argument convinced him. For the Führer, with all the tasks he had to perform, his energy consumption was so high that you couldn't wait until a substance found its way into the blood in tablet form via the digestive system. For Hitler, it made sense. Morell wants to give me a big iodine injection as well as a heart, liver, chalk, and vitamin injection. He learned in the tropics that medicine must be injected into the veins. The busy ruler lived in constant fear of not being able to function properly, that he wouldn't be able to do everything he needed to do, and that he wouldn't be able to perform due to illness. Since he believed no one else was capable of carrying out his duties, from 1937, Morell's unconventional methods of treatment quickly gained in importance. Several injections a day were soon the norm. Hitler became used to his skin being punctured and having what was assumed to be a potent substance flowing into his veins. Each time it happened, he felt instantly better. the fine stainless steel needle that conjured up immediate recovery, was fully in line with his nature. His situation required constant mental alertness, physical vitality, and hands-on decisiveness. Neuroses and other psychological inhibitions had to be switched off at all times, as if by the push of a button, and he himself needed to be permanently refreshed. Soon his new physician seldom left the patient's side, and Hani Morell's fears came true. Her husband had no time for his practice anymore. A locum physician had to be installed at Kurfürstendamm, and Morell later claimed, oscillating between pride and fatalism, that he was the only person who had seen Hitler every day, or at least every second day, since 1936. Before every big speech, the Reich Chancellor now allowed himself a power injection in order to work at the peak of his capabilities. Colds, which could have kept him from appearing in public, were ruled out from the start by intravenous vitamin supplements. To be able to hold his arm up for as long as possible when doing the Nazi salute, Hitler trained with chest expanders and also allowed his body to snack on glucose and vitamins. The glucose, administered intravenously, gave the brain a blast of energy after 20 seconds, while the combined vitamins allowed Hitler to address his troops or the people wearing a thin brown shirt uniform even on cold days without showing signs of physical weakness. When he suddenly lost his voice before a speech at Innsbruck in 1937, Morell quickly alleviated the nuisance with an injection. At first, Hitler's digestive problems improved as well. And so the promised estate for the personal physician was given to Morell on Berlin's exclusive Schwanenwerder Island, next door to the propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. The elegant villa surrounded by a hand-forged iron fence at 24-26 Inselstrasse wasn't a complete gift. The Morells had to buy it themselves for 338,000 Reichsmarks, although they did receive an interest-free loan of 200,000 Reichsmarks from Hitler that was later converted into a fee for treatment. The new home didn't just bring advantages to the celebrity doctor, who had now been elevated to the highest social stratum. Morell had to employ domestic servants and a gardener, and his basic expenses soared, even though he wasn't automatically earning more. But now there was no turning back. He enjoyed his new lifestyle too much, as well as his immediate proximity to power. Hitler had also become more than used to the doctor, brushing aside any criticism of the man, who many people in the hard-fought-for inner circles found less than appetizing. Morell wasn't there to be sniffed at, Hitler professed. He was there to keep him healthy. To give the former society doctor a hint of seriousness, Hitler awarded him an honorary professorship in 1938. Volkswagen, Volksdrogen. The first years in Morell's treatment developed into an extremely successful period for Hitler, who was cured of his intestinal cramps and, always dosed up on vitamins, was healthy and agile. His popularity grew unstintingly, chiefly due to the fact that the German economy was enjoying a boom. Economic independence became a fixed point in Nazi politics. It would produce a higher standard of living, but also meant that war was inevitable. The plans for expansion were already in the desk drawers. The First World War had made it clear that Germany had too few natural raw materials for armed conflict with its neighbors, and so artificial ones had to be created. Synthetic gasoline produced from coal, as well as Buna, synthetic rubber, were at the center of the development of IG Farben, which had gone on growing in power within the Nazi state and had consolidated its position as a global player in the chemical industry. Its board described itself as the Council of the Gods. Under Hermann Göring's tutelage, the economy was to become independent from all imported materials that could be produced in Germany itself. Of course, that also included drugs. While the Nazis' war on drugs brought down the consumption of heroin and cocaine, the development of synthetic stimulants was accelerated and led to a new blossoming within the pharmaceutical companies. The workforces of Merck in Darmstadt, Bayer in the Rhineland, and Boehringer in Ingelheim grew, and wages rose. Expansion was also on the cards at Tembler. The head pharmacist, Dr. Fritz Hausschild, had heard how the Olympic Games in Berlin in 1936 had been influenced by a substance called benzedrine, a successful amphetamine from the United States, and still a legal doping product at the time. At Temmler, all development resources were now pooled in that direction, since the company was convinced that a performance-enhancing substance was a perfect fit for an age in which everyone was talking about new beginnings. Hauschild turned to the work of Japanese researchers who had synthesized an extremely stimulating molecule called N-methylamphetamine as early as 1887 and crystallized it in its pure form in 1919. It was on sale there under